Let's go 800 meters beneath the surface of the ocean.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's incredible.
Like, I've seen this, what I'm seeing, 100 times on video.
There's just so much life.
Yeah.
These two researchers, Anna Hildebrand and John Pullman, were on the Alvin, a manned submersible owned by the U.S. Navy and operated by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. They were exploring Astoria Canyon off the coast of Oregon. I documented their research cruise for the WFSU documentary, Secrets of the Sea. The documentary is about methane on the seafloor and about the ocean carbon cycle. But, like John and Anna, I was intrigued by all the life they found in the areas around the methane seeps. How does life support itself where there is no sunlight? And just how much is alive down there? We talk life at the ocean bottom on Coast to Canopy, the podcast on a quest to find the essence of natural North Florida and off the coast of Florida. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas with WFSU Public Media. My guests today are joining us from across the country and also closer to home. Joining us remotely is Dr. Ellen Lalk, a stable isotope biogeochemist for the U.S. Geological Survey at their Woods Hole campus. Thanks for joining us, Ellen.
Thanks.
Also joining us remotely is Dr. Karen Lloyd, Wrigley Chair in Environmental Studies and Professor of Earth Sciences and Marine and Environmental Biology at the University of Southern California. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Ellen and Karen are both part of the research team we met in Secrets of the SEEP, and both were lucky to participate in Alvin Dives. And joining me in the studio is Dr. Amy Bacco-Taylor. Amy is a professor of oceanography and environmental science at Florida State University. Thanks for coming in on finals week, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
And Amy, you've also dived on the Alvin, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Gotcha. So since I have three Alvin veterans, I want to start by jumping into the Alvin and heading down to the seafloor near the edge of the continental shelf. What kinds of things are we seeing?
Usually where you do an Alvin dive, you start out in blue water, so you're not passing much continental shelf or slope on your way down. It's all blue water. So the biggest thing you notice is a drastic change in the wavelengths of light that you see. It goes from bright daylight through different shades of blue, like shades of blue that you've never seen before, really beautiful shades of blue, and then it gets darker and darker, and eventually there's no ambient light, and you start to see bioluminescence.
Okay, very cool. And then so once you're sort of closer to the sea bottom, sort of towards the edge of the continental shelf, I guess if you're like on this cruise where they were looking for methane seeps, what kinds of things did you see when you were down off the coast of Oregon?
Well, as we get closer to the seafloor and it starts to come into view, the first thing that we saw was hundreds of pink starfish scattered around the soft, light brown sediment. And from that point, started hunting for methane, signs of methane seeps. While we're searching, we know we've found that when we get to patches of the seafloor where the sediment turns from that light brown color to black with patches of white microbes. And if you look in the right place, you might even see some things like bubbles escaping into the water column or some mineral formations.
What are some other sort of features we might see on the seafloor? Things like hydrothermal vents, mud volcanoes, brine lakes?
I've dived on those different formations. I can speak to that a little bit.
Yeah.
They don't all occur at once. You know, there's different geological features that drive these different seafloor features, but a lot of them are also associated with methane and gases coming up. So you often see very similar shrimp and crabs and worms, no matter what the geological source is. So, you know, that can affect the temperature of the fluids coming out, which can affect what animals you see. But pretty much all of these places at the seafloor are like oases in the desert where you find lots of abundant life.
Gotcha. And then one feature I thought was kind of interesting, I was reading, Amy, about some of your research, is whale falls. Can you explain what that is?
Sure, yeah. So whale falls are basically when a whale dies, its body often sinks to the seafloor. We think about them washing up on beaches, but actually they all eventually end up on the seafloor. And so, you know, once the whale reaches the seafloor, then there's this huge amount of organic material, food, on the seafloor that deep sea usually doesn't get a lot of food from the surface. So there's this huge like buffet of, you know, whale flesh for all of these organisms to feed on. So the initial community that you see on the whale falls includes a broad array of different scavenging species. So there'll be large sharks. And one of the more common species that feeds on the whale soft tissue are hagfish. It would be literally like thousands of hagfish swarming all over the whale, eating, you know, they actually eat the whale from the inside out. So they find a hole and go inside and like eat the flesh. And then it's really a pleasant way to go, I guess. And then as there gets to be less soft tissue, the scavengers get smaller. And so you might see, you know, like thousands of amphipods in big swarms feeding on the soft tissue. And then there's also all kinds of organisms that live in the sediments, feeding on all of that organic material as it rots.
Right. And then some of them are, I guess, what you would call chemosynthetic organisms there towards the end of the decomposition of the whale.
Yeah. So once all the tissue is removed, the soft tissue, the bones actually contain a very high concentration of lipids or fats. And that gets, because it's trapped inside the bones, it gets broken down really slowly through microbial processes. And just like anything that rots, you know, you get that hydrogen sulfide smell. And so it creates this hydrogen sulfide, which then fuels a chemosynthetic community on the whale falls for a period of time. And also in areas in the sediments where a lot of the soft tissue gets trapped, that they can also form in those areas for short periods of time as well.
Chemosynthetic. Chemosynthesis is like photosynthesis, but instead of sunlight, microorganisms use chemical energy to create food. At methane seeps, this energy is provided by methane and hydrogen sulfide. One product of chemosynthesis is the focus of Ellen's research, dissolved organic carbon, or DOC.
So when I think about organic matter in the ocean, on a larger scale, we can think of animals like whales or dolphins, plants like seagrass, or microorganisms like algae that can form things like red tides. And all of these living things take carbon from their environments to grow and also excrete carbon back into their environments as waste, just at different scales. So at the base of this food web, meaning at this microbial level, the carbon that's getting taken and excreted is so small that it's actually in a dissolved form, which when you get to thinking about molecules is a size classification of molecules. So these are really, really small organic molecules. And DOC is an incredibly, which is dissolved organic carbon, is an incredibly diverse mixture of different compounds. These are molecules that are coming from life itself. So it can involve things like carbohydrates, sugars. It's incredibly complex. And some of the chemicals in dissolved organic carbon in the deep ocean are more accessible to microbes than others.
As we learn in Secrets of the Seep, there is a lot of DOC in the ocean. Again, here's John Pullman, a research chemist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
Dissolved organic carbon is the largest reservoir of organic matter in the oceans. Methane in the seafloor is the most abundant form of methane on Earth.
Methane and DOC feed a lot of life in the ocean that we can't see with the naked eye.
Up to 90% of methane that migrates to the seafloor at seeps is consumed by microbes. And once you get that methane into the water column, it becomes a lot easier to oxidize that methane. So when you look at waters at the surface of the ocean that are above methane seeps, there's not a very strong signal in that water of methane making it to the atmosphere because there's so much microbial processing that happens in the deep ocean around those methane seeps.
One way to understand that processing that Ellen's talking about is that, you know, we use natural gas to heat our houses. And so what the reaction, the chemical reaction that makes fuel for, you know, for things like heating your house is methane burning with oxygen. And it's weird to think about things burning in the ocean because the ocean's wet. So you're not going to light a match down there, but chemically it's the same process. It's oxygen and methane reacting with each other. And in the same way that it creates a ton of energy up at the surface, when we use it, it also creates a lot of energy in the bottom of the ocean. And so that's a great thing. We should be really happy about that, because if that weren't sort of burning off the methane, then it would be getting into the atmosphere and we would be in real trouble.
When I think of the processing of methane in shallow sediments and also in the deep ocean, I kind of think of it like a chemical currency. Like microbes can be given dissolved carbon from the environment, like methane, And they can either put this carbon into their piggy bank and use it to grow themselves, or they can modify and exchange this carbon and spend it back out into the environment. And these chemical exchanges are how microbes convert methane into things like dissolved organic carbon, which is a major focus of the work that we were doing out offshore Oregon.
So Karen, I watched your TED talk on microbes. Like, you have a couple that I watched. You say that, you know, seeps and all that are these oases in the ocean, but then all that mud, how much life is in ocean mud that we would never see or we didn't even really know about until fairly recently?
Yeah, that's a fascinating sort of area because we're talking about these methane oases. So if you have oases, then that means the rest of it is desert, right? Like to have an oasis means the rest of it is kind of boring. For years, I've sort of naturally gravitated to this boring place just because it's common. It covers like the vast majority of Earth's surface is covered by oceans, and the vast majority of the mud underneath our oceans is mud that doesn't have a methane seep. It doesn't have anything really interesting going on with it at all. And I've got some colleagues who've done a really great job estimating the total number of living microbial cells in this sort of boring ocean mud. And it's like 10 to the 29 living cells, which is like a hard number to really conceptualize in your brain. So it's 10,000 times more than the number of stars in the universe, like not the galaxy, but the universe. So it's really, it's a lot. So even though it doesn't seem like there's much going on in those places, it's a real ecosystem and they're doing some interesting things.
If I could just add to that, I think that a lot of the soft sediment areas that are around cold seeps and away from these sort of oases, they look like deserts to your naked eye. But what's actually happening is that instead of living on the surface where you can see everything, most of the organisms live in the sediments. And so if you could actually take samples of the sediments and look at those under the microscope, you would see that there's actually a huge diversity of very small organisms that live within the sediments. So there's still tons of life there. It's just not out in the open where you can see it.
What kinds of organisms are we talking about?
Largely polychaete worms are the most common groups that you find there, but there's also a lot of crustaceans and a whole suite of invertebrate taxa.
Gotcha. And so these are all just like in the mud.
Yeah, they live within the mud. Some of them burrow and dig within the mud. We call those size class of organisms macrofauna. And then there's even smaller organisms that we call miofauna that actually live. They're so small they can live in between the grains of sand or sediment on the seafloor.
Gotcha. What are they eating down there?
A lot of them are eating, well, the smallest ones are eating microbes. The miofauna usually eat microbes and sometimes each other. And then the macrofauna eat the miofauna. And then we have larger organisms that we call megafauna, and they will come along and, you know, burrow in the sediments and eat the macrofauna and miofauna.
So at the bottom of the ocean, there's no light, and all life on Earth, on the surface of the Earth, sort of is based on photosynthesis and light being converted to carbohydrates that everything through the food web eats. So down here at the bottom of the ocean, we have microbes that are creating this other kind of food web that converts methane, which is hydrocarbon, into a usable carbon. So talk about how do they do that? What are they creating specifically that things are eating?
Do you want molecules?
Well, I mean, I study bigger organisms, so the way I understand it, I mean, they could give you at the molecular level what's happening. But basically, the microbes create simple sugars, is the way I understand it, and then the organisms that eat the microbes, that's where they get their organic carbon, is from basically the bodies of the microbes. But then also, there's microbes living endosymbiotically within the bodies of larger organisms. And so they produce organic carbon that the host organism absorbs directly from the microbe, and they get their nutrition that way. And so it's like a symbiotic relationship where the host organism gives the microbe a place to live and supplies some of the sulfide and other compounds that the microbes need. And then in return, the microbes give the organisms the organic carbon that they need.
And so around methane seep areas, one thing I guess that people were looking for on the cruise were a lot of clams, right? And so there's a lot of clams, like acarax, I guess, that have this relationship. And so that's part of how that carbon enters the food web.
Most of these invertebrates that you find at methane seeps, if you start looking inside their gills, you find symbiotic chemosynthetic organisms. So, I mean, it was hard. That's why I think my difficulty in finding an answer to your question is informative. You said, well, what does that carbon go into? And I'm like, well, look at the clams.
Yeah.
You know, it goes into worms and, you know, little creepy crawlies.
What other animals are in the seep setting that are, you said almost any animal down there would have a relationship with microbes. What other kind of animals are right there at the seep setting that are doing this other than clams?
Tube worms, most people, I guess the easiest analogy of those, they usually show, if you watch any type of nature special, they usually show these really long red tube worms that occur at hydrothermal vents. They're very like bright red with like a white rim around them, and they're sticking out of white tubes, and they're very photogenic, so you often see pictures like that. So the ones that we find at cold seeps are very closely related to that, but not nearly as photogenic. They're usually a bit smaller and have slower growth rates than the ones that you find at hydrothermal vents. But for a long time, we thought that tube worms were their own phylum, and we figured out through genetic work that they're actually a type of polychaete worm. They're just super highly evolved and specialized to the chemosynthetic ecosystems. So they've not only lost, like they don't have the usual like seedy and everything like other polychaetes have, but they also have no gut. They've developed this specialized organ inside their body called a trophosome. And in that trophosome, they house these chemoautotrophic bacteria. And they also have a specialized physiology where they can absorb hydrogen sulfide from the water and bring it to the bacteria. Hydrogen sulfide is usually toxic for most organisms, so this is a pretty highly specialized adaptation. And then the microbes give the tube worms organic carbon compounds in return. So they provide all the nutrition for the tube worm in exchange for the tube worm giving them like a house and bringing in that hydrogen sulfide for them.
We have the animals at the seep setting who are helping to convert these hydrocarbons. What eats them? Do we know?
Because they live in these settings where there's high concentrations of methane and hydrogen sulfide, which again are toxic to most organisms that haven't developed these adaptations, there's not a ton of predators that live directly within the chemosynthetic ecosystem. There are a few different types of crabs that will, you know, take little pinches off of these organisms, and if an organism dies, there's scavengers that'll come in and take tissue from the dying organisms. But I would say that like number and type of predators that you find in these ecosystems is much lower than outside of the ecosystems because of the chemistry in the area, the high concentrations of these toxic compounds.
Right. So how much of this carbon enters sort of a wider food web? I guess how far does the energy that comes out of these seeps when it gets converted into something edible, how far does it get out, or do we know that?
I think that's one of the big questions in chemosynthetic ecosystem research right now is how what is the sphere of influence of these chemosynthetic ecosystems out into the broader community. We suspect that it is significant, but we don't it hasn't been fully quantified yet. I know they have more to say about it, but I'll just add my couple thoughts real quick.
I agree with that.
You know, there's several potential ways besides the DOC and scavengers and predators that come into the ecosystem. There's also all of the larger invertebrates that live at the ecosystem release their young, like they spawn their larvae and eggs and sperm and everything into the water column. And so that is one potential way that the organic carbon produced at the seep is released into the other areas in the form of like the babies basically. And then anything that lives around there can capture those larvae and that would be a food source for them. And the others can explain better the microbial side of it.
No, I want to know that answer. I'd love to know how much of the carbon that we appreciate on the surface of Earth comes from chemosynthesis. You know, it's something that is often ignored because we have this dominant signal of photosynthesis up at the surface, and it's certainly not going to be anywhere near as much. We know that. But like, if it just stopped, if you like snuffed out the chemosynthetic engine inside Earth one day, would that affect us? Would we even notice?
Right.
So that's a good question.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So during the cruise, there was the last Alvin dive when you were on, Karen. So those sable fish were bothering the submarine. So I was,
oh my goodness.
and you
didn't say this was like a horror podcast.
I just want you to relive the horror of the fish
or
keeping
maybe
you from
it's
working.
Like a drama.
It was stressful for the crew on the Alvin, but it made for an entertaining scene in the documentary.
This is so insane. This is so insane. Oh my God. Oh my God. We've just gone up. I think what happened is we've gone up, attracted every single fish, and brought it around with us, and that's what happened. It's like throughout the day, they just keep coming.
Sablefish is a commercially important seafood species, usually found higher up in the water column. I found a research paper that suggests that they may be part of this chemosynthetic food web, but no one knows for sure. Microbes consume a lot of methane, but the rest of that food web is still pretty mysterious.
Can I talk about the fish?
Yes.
I was thinking this was either a horror podcast, now that we're bringing up the fish, or drama, but now I realize it's therapy. So these fish, the weird thing is, you know, we've all dived in submarines and you use these, sorry, submersibles. If it's like, if it has a support boat, you call it a submersible. They, you know, usually you're deep enough down that you're not getting very active, energetic organisms. So, you know, things are slow. The fish will move, you know, quickly if they get scared. But generally speaking, things are pretty stable and everybody's peaceful and you do your work and you all agree, the animals and you have a nice conversation and you end up with science. This situation was something that I had never seen before. And the pilot, who has done far more dives than I had never seen before. And these sable fish are sport fish and they're very energetic. They have a lot of food resources. They feed up in the, actually, I guess I don't know where they feed, but they're energetic. And they were attracted to the submersible and maybe because of the light. And we would settle somewhere and try to start working and they would start swimming around us in this big like ball, you know, maybe 50 of these big fish. And as they did that, they would go through the sediments around us. So they would kick up just en masse, like a big giant poof, all these sediments would cloud our vision. And so we had maybe 5 minutes after we would land in a place to do any work until we lost all visibility and we couldn't even see the robotic arm. And I'd never seen that happen before. But that's interesting, Rob. I didn't think about the fact that these big energetic fish, what were they doing at 800 meters water depth? They shouldn't be that low. And I did look up later and I saw that they are known to go that deep. You know, that's not like a discovery that we made.
Right.
But why? You know, all the good stuff is up in the surface. You know, that's where all the jellyfish are. That's where all the little fish that you eat. I'm sorry, I'm not a like organismal biologist, so there's probably smarter ways to say that. But maybe they are part of that deep sea ecosystem. Maybe they are how some of that carbon from chemosynthesis is getting out into the surface world. And I don't know. But as you said, you know, what you really asked me to say is why this is hard to study. And part of it is that things like that happen. You know, that's one dive that, you know, could have been 9 hours, but we cut it short because the fish were just useless and we couldn't do anything down there. And I think also the weather was starting to get a little rocky up at the surface too. So if that's how you access your study site, you know, compare that to somebody studying a forest. You can live in the forest. You can talk to the groups of people who have been living in the forest for thousands of years. The amount of information that we can get just for walking up to a place, for reading a book from people who've lived there at the surface, none of that applies in the bottom of the ocean. It's just it's an alien landscape. Just to finish my therapy thing, even though we had basically very little science happen on that dive, I was still happy and thrilled and pleased to be able to get to dive because it's so rare to get to have that. Just even though it was a terrible dive, I'm so grateful to have gone to the seafloor yet again.
Yeah, Ellen, I think in the documentary, you had a thing you said, when you go down there and maybe you've seen video and you've studied it in all these other ways, being able to see it in person, what does that add to your life as a researcher doing the work in this environment?
Well, I think we have personal reasons why we like seeing these sites in person, but also logistical scientific reasons why we need to see these sites in person. Personally, I think I mentioned in the documentary, it is a big scientific dream of mine to be able to do something like dive in the Alvin and make that connection with an environment that I spend a lot of my life studying. Logistically, being able to go down, see the site in person and make real-time decisions about where we're taking samples from get the full scope of the environment from where we can see it inside the submersible and take really precise samples is why we do it. I know you were asking about what goes into being able to study these types of environments. And what I was thinking about was in the moment when I'm down there, you know, I feel like an explorer. But the truth of the matter is by the time that I'm at the seafloor in the sub, years and years of work have gone into probing that site from a distance, making pretty detailed maps, testing all sorts of hypotheses that we use to develop a strategy for why we want to go to a particular part of the world. And I felt by the time that opportunity came up, not really fear, but just excitement and a really deep sense of duty, of the responsibility of making decisions on behalf of an entire team, especially in light of our trouble with weather and getting a lot fewer dives than we thought we were going to get. And just like the weight of thinking through the choices that I'll have to make to help other scientists on our team get samples to do good work. And also the years and years of planning of other members of our team and the scientific community towards getting the ship time and the dive time to take those samples.
And about that planning too, I think one thing that by the end I was kind of impressed with was that, oh no, you only got to do three dives, but you had all these other alternative methods too. I didn't want to make it seem like, oh no, it was a whole waste of time out there for a week and a half. I mean, you had all these other ways to sample. You had an alternative site to go to when the weather was too rough at Hydrate Ridge. I mean, yeah, so it's
difficult. I will say too, like none of that was, some of that was thought out, but I just wanted to give people an impression of how all that happens. It was very on the fly and lucky. You know, that was because our colleague, Carolyn Ruppel at USGS, had another site in her back pocket. And so when we were talking to her when we were on the ship, she was like, she suggested it as an option. So she kind of saved the day there. I mean, we did plan for coring. A lot of how we saved that was that we did a lot of taking sediment cores, but we just didn't even realize like how much good information we were going to get from those sediment cores until after we took them.
Is it always a risk when you go out to sea for a certain amount of time that it's just so bad that you just can't do it? And
Yeah, definitely. I think that every cruise that goes out, you usually lose at least one day to bad weather. You try to plan in one or two weather days, depending on the length of the cruise, but it's sort of unavoidable. The conditions, the sea conditions have to be just right to be able to launch a vehicle. And so if the seas are over a certain sea state, or the winds are too strong, or the currents are too strong, then you can't put the vehicle in the water. And so you can't expect to have all those perfect conditions like every single day that you're out, especially the longer you're out.
Yeah, I think we're ready to wrap up here. So I'm going to go closing thoughts for everybody. We'll start with you, Karen. I know, Karen, you have something you want to announce. You have something. It's the day this podcast hits, you've got something coming out additionally to this podcast.
Yeah, I have a book coming out May 13th. And I've been working on that book. Actually, this relates to this cruise because I was basically talking about it the whole time I was on the cruise, and various folks on the boat gave me input and advice about it. It was really a labor of love. And I basically just talk about what it's like to do this exciting field work. And then I go to get into the nitty gritty of the science as well. So hopefully people will enjoy it. It's called Intraterrestrials: Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth, from Princeton University Press.
Cool name. Ellen, any closing thoughts?
I think that it's profoundly humbling to be face to face with the fragility of some of these environments that are often untouched frontiers. And each dive that we get to do represents an opportunity to shed a little bit of light on some of the unknowns of our planet. And the documentary that you produced, I think, captures really beautifully the experience and the motivation for doing this work.
Thank you. Amy, any closing thoughts?
That's a hard one to follow up. That was really great. If I could just add something related to the like going there in person question you were asking earlier. I think one of the benefits of going there in person is that you get a really much better sense of the three-dimensional layout of an ecosystem. When you go down in a submersible, you're looking out a window, and so you can see sort of everything and how things are in relation to each other and some of the interactions that are going on. Hmm. And it's very different from the experience of using an ROV where you just have a camera that's looking right in a finite area at what's going on. It's sort of like the difference between like seeing some place you want to go on vacation, right? You see it on TV and you know that it's beautiful and you know that it's interesting, right? But you can't go and tell people, oh, like, you know, I saw the Eiffel Tower on TV, so I don't need to go see it in person, right? You want to go there and see it in person. And you go there and you see it in person, and you realize not only is there an Eiffel Tower, but there's all these people walking around the Eiffel Tower, and there's vendors there, and there's cool food over here, and there's all these other different things happening besides just the tower, right?
Yeah.
And so when you go down in a submersible, you really get a much better sense of all those different things that are happening, whereas using an ROV is more like just watching it on TV. Another advantage of submersibles is that they're much more maneuverable than other types of vehicles. And so if you're going along and you see something that you want to sample, you can like stop on a dime and just go there and sample it. Whereas with using an ROV, it's connected to a ship, and sometimes it also has like a drop weight between the ROV and the ship. And so if you want to stop and sample something, you have to stop the ROV and the drop weight and the ship. And by the time you've done all those things, you've drifted way past whatever you wanted to study, and it's harder to get back to it.
Thank you.
That's a great articulation. I'm going to borrow that.
Thank you, Ellen, Karen, and Amy, for joining us on this episode of Coast to Canopy. The ocean bottom isn't easy to access, and I feel fortunate to have been able to document research there. All of the audio we hear from the Alvin Dives was provided by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, as was the Alvin video in Secrets of the Seep. You can stream Secrets of the Seep on the PBS app and at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. I hope you enjoyed our little voyage to the bottom of the sea. Maybe one day science can tell us if we're eating methane-derived carbon in our seafood. Wouldn't that be wild? For WFSU Public Media, I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas.